five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. I love you. A, B, C, D. Can I bring my friend to tea? E, F, G, H, I, J. I love you.
Boom, 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 boom.
Sail the ship.
Boom, boom, boom.
Chop the tree.
Boom, boom, boom.
Skip the rope.
Boom, boom, boom. Look at me.
All together now.
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 Black, white, green, red. Can I take my friend to bed? Pink, brown, yellow, orange, and blue.
Welcome to All Together Now. That was a little joke by my sound engineer, Matt Bogard, who is apparently a fan of the Beatles. People have said to me, oh, do you have to get permission from the Beatles to use that phrase All Together Now because of that song they did? And I said, no, I think every choir director who speaks English around the world has said All Together Now about a zillion times. But anyway, for a refreshing change, thanks, Matt. We'll go back to Bonnie Raitt next time, okay? Well, I hope you were listening last week when my new co-host, Eleanor LeCain, hosted her first All Together Now program. From now on, Eleanor and I are going to be hosting on alternate Thursdays, and we'll each be thinking about interrelatedness from various directions. Today, we're going to be talking about the dynamics of religion in the modern world. After 9/11, there was a big scramble at many American universities, including the most elite, to bring religious literacy, as it's called, that is, knowledge about the world's religions, into the core subjects, the core structure of what they figured an educated person should know. And since then, unrelated perhaps, young adults in this country have continued to opt out of membership and participation in organized religion. And according to recent surveys, almost 30% of Americans under 30 are not affiliated with any religion. Although many of those people, when they're surveyed, also state that they are interested in spirituality, they just don't feel a connection with any religious institution. And one reason for this social trend may be the rigidity that has emerged in recent decades, both in our politics and our religion's stances on social and ecological issues. And there was an article in the New York Times last Sunday mentioning a new book that was out by the political scientist Robert Putnam, who did Bowling Alone, and David Campbell. Their new book is American Grace, in which they found that in recent years have seen the sharpest points of disagreement between religious believers of nearly all stripes. And between those folks and those who denounce religious belief of all types. Now, I mention that just because young listeners may think it's always been this way, extreme animosity flying in all directions regarding religion in the United States, or even between Democrats and Republicans. But it hasn't always been like that. This is a development over very recent decades. So they go on to say that the last few election cycles have made it clear that many evangelicals think that those without religion are dangerously wrong on many issues. And then there's this crop, as they put it, of equally committed atheists and agnostics who have reciprocated with vigor. So Professors Campbell and Putnam do note that it's the people at the extremes who are the most engaged in framing this polarization. But, you know, it affects us all because it affects the way public discussion and debate then takes place on the issues. So I would like to add that organized religion itself is an interesting institution because it's the only one that has a presence at both the local level, that is, in practically every neighborhood, and at the national and international levels. So imagine if all that structural presence and people power got serious about, say, slowing global climate disruption and lots of other key issues. Today we're going to hear from someone who's been thinking a lot about these issues and challenges, and she's been working full-time on them. Marcia Beauchamp is the U.S. Education Manager for the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, an international foundation that's headquartered in London. She's responsible for coordinating the Faith to Faith program in the United States, and she's also responsible for managing the foundation's relationship with Yale University in the Faith and Globalization Initiative. Marcia Beauchamp has been involved in education in the United States for nearly 20 years. The focus of her work has been addressing the presence of religion in American education, particularly public schools. Marcia Beauchamp was previously the Religious Freedom Program's coordinator for the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center. And from 2000 to 2005, she chaired the Religion in Schools Task Force at the American Academy of Religion. Her writing on issues related to religion in schools has been published by Social Studies Review, Religion and Education, and other publications. She holds a master's degree in theological studies from Harvard Divinity School and a PhD in philosophy and religion from the California Institute of Integral Studies. Marcia Beauchamp, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Charlene. It's wonderful to join you.
Well, I would like to start by asking you to orient the listeners and myself, really, about the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Let me start here with just a short description of what they say about themselves on their website, which is TonyBlairFaithFoundation.org. The Tony Blair Faith Foundation promotes understanding and respect between, oh dear, I think they mean among, although that might be a British usage, we can't know, between the world's major religions. We believe this is central to a policy to secure sustained peace. The world continues to become increasingly interconnected. Old boundaries of culture and identity are being eroded. However, faith has remained at the core of life for billions of people. It underpins systems of thought and behavior. Faith can be used to unite people around a common cause, but too often faith can also be distorted and used to fan the flames of hatred and extremism. The Tony Blair Faith Foundation supports and collaborates with those who seek peace. We educate and develop understanding about religion in the modern world by promoting leadership, literacy, and lives. And they explain by that they mean with leadership, we seek to ensure that current and future leaders understand the role religion plays in the modern globalizing world. And then by literacy, they mean we educate and support young people to help them to become well-educated global citizens. And with regard to lives, we help religious communities in more than 140 countries work together to save lives. So that's their social action project. We do this through three programs: Faith and Globalization, Faith to Faith, and Faith Act. So that's the basic sense of what they're up to. Marcia, what does this international foundation look like from the inside? Would you start by giving us an overview of the work of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation and what led you to do this work? And then after that, I'd like to go separately into each of the two project areas in which you are situated.
Okay. I'd be happy to try and do all of that. I think you did a great job of really sort of describing what the work of the foundation is and how we're focusing it. And actually, all three of the projects that you just mentioned are seen as reinforcing all three of those different areas of focus that the foundation has. So, mm-hmm. from the inside, what it looks like is a very busy and very global kind of approach to really addressing not only religious differences but also cultural differences, and also including people of what the way we might say it in the United States, people of no faith. But I think one of the reasons that we have used the term faith more often than we use the term religion is because inside the foundation we recognize that people who don't count themselves as a member of a structured religious organization still see themselves often as people, as you said earlier, of spiritual persuasion. So their commitment to something larger than themselves does play a role in the decisions that they make in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very busy trying to, at both the university level and at the secondary level, which we can talk more about, pursuing the literacy piece and also the piece in terms of developing leadership for the future. And then in the Faith Act program, that has been primarily focused on mobilizing religious leaders in various parts of the world to work on primarily, so far it's been, health care issues. So our most successful program in that area has been working on malaria prevention and malaria education in Sierra Leone, and we've been quite successful at mobilizing those religious communities to do that work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of an overview of what we're doing. And I guess I got involved in this. That's a sort of a complicated question, how I got involved in this, but I guess it started as far back as being raised in a family where religion was something we talked a lot about. Both my parents were what I would call free thinkers now.
Mm-hmm.
We attended church. I grew up in Oklahoma and went to a Methodist church growing up. But we would come home from church after at the end of Sunday, and we would, what I would now call, deconstruct the sermon around the dinner table. My dad would ask us, wow.
That's why you ended up at Harvard Divinity School.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. My dad would literally ask us questions about the sermon and what we thought about it, and encouraged us really to develop our own points of view, and with the idea in mind that people do all have different perspectives and takes on these issues, and that it was fascinating to learn about that.
Hmm.
So I grew up in a family that thought it was really interesting, and yes, I think that is what led me to Harvard and beyond to study, you know, the differences that we
uh-huh.
have.
Wow. So just to bring everybody up to speed on, you know, your memory bank here, Tony Blair founded this after he left office as Prime Minister of England. How involved is he in the Tony Blair Faith Foundation?
He's actually quite involved. He remains, you know, the sort of, you know, driving force behind all of the work that we do. He
mm-hmm.
he's very much involved in deciding how we move forward. Obviously, with the expertise that he's gathered from a variety of different institutional backgrounds that now people the foundation, but certainly his vision that coming out of his time as Prime Minister, the story goes, and in fact it's in his autobiography, that he met with Bill Clinton, a good friend and former, you know, leader with him, to ask, you know, what should I do now, basically. And out of that discussion came the clarity for him that religion was one of those forces that had, I think, in a way surprised him in its power to, as he puts it, be either a force of good or a force of conflict in the world, and that
mm-hmm.
it was something he wanted to address.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really been, that continues to be our driving force.
Mm-hmm. And at least the media in Britain reported that he almost converted to Catholicism. His wife is Catholic, didn't quite do that, but did get interested in religion after he left office. And not to draw any conclusions about whether or not he has any regrets, and I guess he doesn't have any regrets of believing the Bush administration's hoo-ha and sending all those British soldiers in with the invasion in Iraq, which sent his popularity numbers plunging mm-hmm. because a lot of people didn't believe about the secret informant that the Bush administration said they had. So he has really built up this planetary work since then, and it's extremely interesting from what I could learn off the website. So let's move into this first big area that you're involved in, this face-to-faith program.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I could tell, it's very smart because it accomplishes so many things at one time. But why don't you tell us about it, and then I'll see if I have any questions here.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I have to say, after all these years of working in education around how we educate people to be religiously literate in a 21st century world, but also how we make use of all of the most innovative technologies and pedagogies that are out there, this program really does all of that. The program is designed for students aged 12 to 17, so secondary students, and that's both for cognitive reasons, you know, cognitive developmental reasons, but it's also partially because, at least in the United States, that's the level at which kind of constitutionally we've agreed that we can teach about religion and children can talk together about their religious faith in the context of a public school under the right restrictions. So the program has several different parts. We've developed five different teaching modules. Four of those teach about content about religion, but they do it in a thematic way around a global issue of concern. So the idea is that students are learning about the perspectives of different faith stances as well as secular perspectives on a variety of issues that need us all to work together to solve. The environmental crisis being one of those, wealth and poverty being one of them, sort of self-expression issues being one, and peacemaking being one. The introductory module is a separate thing. It's the one module we require that all teachers teach and all students learn because it is focused on dialogue skills. So the introductory module is meant to prepare students to enter into this really global space where they will get opportunities both to interact with students from around the world at an online community that is secure and monitored, so only students who are part of this program can have access to one another through this monitored site, and then in video conferences, live facilitated video conferences, where students get to talk to each other about these issues with the background that they're learning not only about their cultural differences, but also about their different religious or faith-based differences.
So, yeah, I could get that. I still have a question. So it addresses religious literacy, dialogical skills, and empathy, as someone said who put it into his classroom, and he said it addresses all these components very successfully. Before the video conference, where one classroom is hooked up with a classroom in some distant country that speaks the same language, right? And there are 17 countries participating, or more than 400 schools, right? There are lots of languages, and they link up the languages so they can talk to each other. But
well, actually, it's mostly English. Most of the video conferences are done in English. We do have countries in the program where English is not their first language, and we do have some Arabic-speaking facilitators who can conduct video conferences in Arabic. But obviously, if you have Arabic-speaking countries talking to Arabic-speaking countries, there's probably not quite as much exchange of information diversity-wise as there would be otherwise. So we really do conduct most of the video conferences in English, and so far, so good with that. We do sometimes have translators, just so that's clear to the listeners. So.
Okay, but English is probably still the dominant language throughout the Commonwealth countries in Asia, so there's a lot of opportunity here for intercultural dialogue. So I just want to get this straight. So before they get to the video conference stage where one classroom is looking at a screen with a picture of students in another classroom in a distant country, they do some traditional book learning about global issues, ecological issues, or social issues, and also about the religion of the students in the classroom they're about to be hooked up to. Is that right?
Well, it's not necessarily about the religion of the students in the classroom they're about to be hooked up to. We can organize video conferences so that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But they both of the classrooms have studied the same lessons. So, in circumstances where they do have a variety of different religions represented in the video conference, then obviously they are talking to students who are part of the religion that they've studied. But it isn't always the case.
I see.
And it really doesn't matter one way or the other, because what it does is, what the program does is encourages students to be able to talk from their own faith perspective, whether or not it's one that was covered in the lesson.
So yeah, that's what I was wondering. So they're speaking from their background of values, mm-hmm. having been raised in a religion. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Uh-huh. Okay. Because probably there's a mix of religions in both classrooms. And,
yes.
Western world, either England or the United States and elsewhere in the world at this point.
Right.
It's probably
right.
not a question of only one religion. Okay, so that means the preparation then is really about the ecological or social issue, and then I read that the very first video conferencing session is a matter of the students just introducing each other. Each one will say, like, name and what they like to do in their free time and what music they like, what sports they play. It's just, the whole first session is dedicated to just casual introductions. Is that right?
That's pretty much the truth. In some video conferences, it depends. You know, every classroom is different, and every interaction is different. And so sometimes that's about as far along as students can get, because the technology is new to them, and it can be something to overcome just seeing yourself up on a screen and knowing that your voice is being projected. On the other hand, there are often video conferences where students do, before the end of the introductory video conference, get into talking about things like what their own personal definition of faith is. Sometimes that's a question that a facilitator will raise in that very first video conference to get students thinking about, you know, what do these words mean? What are we really talking about?
Uh-huh. Okay, so, I forgot to say, before that first conference, they not only are taught some of the factual information about a particular common issue, ecological or social issue, but they're also trained in some skills of dialogue and considerate conversation with other people. So they bring those skills into the first one, and then they may just dedicate the first one to introductions or a little more. And then in the subsequent ones, they're really focused on these issues the Tony Blair Faith Foundation calls globalized or global issues, which are, I suppose, chosen for being big issues in the place where they live, because it's also quite local. But is it possible that the whole discussion would be about an ecological issue, say, climate change, climate disruption, extreme weather now happening, without bringing any discussion of religion in? Is religion purposely brought in or not brought in? It's just sort of in the background as a values base?
That's a very good question, because really we as a foundation and in training the facilitators who help to guide these conversations, we do purposefully try to bring in the issue of religion and or faith and or secular commitments that impact the discussion at hand, right? Mm-hmm. So we do try to bring people up, the students up to discussing how their particular worldview or faith stance influences the way they look at this particular global issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is one of the pieces that we feel like is at risk in the kinds of, very disagreeable conversations, at least we've been having in the United States, between people of faith in different groups and people of no faith, that they're often we don't get to the place where we try to really understand how it is that a person's worldview influences the way they where they stand on a particular mm-hmm. issue and how it ought to be addressed. Mm-hmm. So what we're really at the very beginning with these students trying to do is help them learn how to have a conversation like that. Mm-hmm. How can you talk about your differences of perspective so that you understand better where someone's coming from? And then once we've been able to do that in a way that reinforces connection rather than breaks it down, we're hoping we can then move to talk about how we solve the problem together mm-hmm. with these different perspectives on maybe how it should be done. How do we start to work together? So that's the point. And so in these video conferences, sometimes there'll be a lot of discussion about the role of our faith or otherwise our worldview or cultural position on how we view an issue. But in a lot of other video conferences, that doesn't get as much traction. And the students want to move right to, what are we going to do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, again, it depends on the group, but our goal is still the same, and that is to help students find ways to respectfully disagree and be able to move on from disagreement to working together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's so important when you say respectfully disagree. It just reminded me of, you know, it's been a goal for about 100 years after World War One. You know, so many people have said, if only people could experience the way people live and are in other cultures and be familiar with it. And so it was thought, oh, maybe if people could travel more, exchange programs might build peace, or that whole international pen pal program mm-hmm. thought that might build peace if people, you know, as young people could write to each other and see, oh, they have some similar concerns, they have families, they have, you know, question marks about what their future will be after school is finished mm-hmm. and all that. And so, but, you know, in our situation, speaking as a Green, it's not mm-hmm. a good idea for people to be jetting around the world, even if they could afford it.
Yeah.
And so I see this as, you know, the next step in that effort to try to get people in their formative years to have some connection with people in a very different culture. Mm-hmm. And I can see what the Tony Blair Faith Foundation is thinking here, that this could only be good for peace building in the future. So I think, you know, that component alone is very important in the design of this program.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those wonderful uses of technology. It's good to see technology being used this way. And, of course, it just keeps, you know, improving all the time. But there have been so many amazing instances where students both see and tend to usually see first the ways they're alike, which is why we sort of start with that introductory video conference that explores what life is like in your place. And they almost always come away saying, wow, we're much more alike than we are different. You know,
uh-huh.
we're all teenagers, and they want to talk about music, and they want to talk about sports. But it's when we start to drill down to what influences you to think the way you do and to want to do what you want to do in the world, you know,
uh-huh.
what influences you to want to change the things that are going wrong in the world. And that's where we start to see, you know, the influences of family, the influences of faith, the influences of culture that are very different. In fact, I was just putting together some clips for a presentation I'm going to be doing in the next few days from a video conference that happened between a school in Spokane, Washington, and a school in India. And the Indian students were all in uniforms. And so the students in Spokane at this public school were really curious about the uniforms and whether the students liked wearing uniforms, and so they asked that question. And it was interesting to see the diversity even in the Indian classroom among students who did like the uniforms and those who didn't. And the ones who did like wearing them were really clear that they saw it as an equalizing force.
Uh-huh.
That with caste or with religious differences, which of course there are as many probably in India as there practically as there are in the United States in one classroom, that was a really big value for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very interesting to see the American students then struggling by asking questions like, well, then how do you express your individuality? And is that a good thing? Do you think you should be able to? So in that instance, I could see so much learning taking place about the ways different cultures even address something like how do we handle individual differences and also create a feeling of being united in some way as a people, too.
Uh-huh, right. Well, I think that question you say you asked them is so key. What are the influences that shape your thinking? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the usual human species narcissistic way is, oh, those people are completely boxed in by all that cultural stuff over there, heavy religion and history and culture, but we're totally free over here. And, you know, it asks everybody to just think about the influences that have gone into shaping you in your formative years. Mm-hmm. So, okay, now we have to pause a moment to go to the break.
Okay.
But we'll be right back. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Marcia Beauchamp. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak, speaking with my guest, Marcia Beauchamp, U.S. Education Manager at the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Their website, again, is TonyBlairFaithFoundation.org. So before we move into the other area in which you work, when you have these video conferencing programs from classrooms in one country, students aged 12 to 17, and then with a distant country, does the volatility of these political and ecological, what I would call eco-social issues, ever, you know, explode, or is it all peace and love?
That's a good question, too. So far, we have had really good luck with not having any explosions in the video conferences or even at our online community. I think that really is due to the fact that not only are the students really well prepared, I think, by their teachers to engage in this, but the teachers who want to be involved in this sort of work have, you know, are committed to the goals and really do a good job of making sure that the students know what it's about and what the purpose is. So I think that's probably part of why it's worked out so well. But I will say that certainly events in the world have affected, you know, the experiences of the students, particularly in recent months. For example, there was a video conference scheduled between a school actually in Oklahoma and Tulsa with a school in Pakistan in early March that at the last minute had to be canceled because the school that was taking place in the video conference was in Karachi. And it was so dangerous in the area around the school that the school had been closed and no mm-hmm. one was allowed onto the streets. And what actually happened as a result of that was, you know, what you would hope would happen, and that was that the teacher in Oklahoma sent a very concerned and supportive email to the teacher in Karachi and said, I'm sorry, we'll have to reschedule, but I'm going to take my students right now to the online community and we'll post our well wishes and our thoughts for your safety uh-huh. at the online community. So I think what's actually happening is that the teachers and students involved in the program are actually starting to do some pretty important peacemaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there seems like there would be so many good effects coming off of this project. And it also seems that it's in sync in a planetary way with something that's been going on in this country. I read an article you wrote about not only this, but your work for 20 years about talking about religion in schools, especially public schools. And I remember having a conversation with the distinguished journalist Margot Adler, who's, mm-hmm. I think, the chief NPR correspondent for New York City. And she told me she'd done a story about how American textbooks treat religion. Mm-hmm. This must have been 20 years ago or so, maybe 15 to 20 years ago. And it was a consensus among religious leaders, talking to people who read the textbooks, the companies, that the safest way to protect everyone in the area of religious difference is to just don't ever mention it. Don't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and then it won't be any subject for, you know, aggression.
Right.
So that led Margot Adler told me, that led to textbooks that would define a pilgrim as someone who goes on a long trip.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
with
Martin
no,
Luther King
no
Jr.
spiritual
was a,
content.
Was a social,
what?
Right, yeah, Martin Luther King Jr. was a social reformer. Right.
Yeah. So that has now been changed, and they're moving more toward this idea, even before 9/11, certainly after, of religious literacy. You know, we now have so many religions in every town, every small town, let alone big city in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we really need to, if we're taking multicultural awareness seriously, to not be ignorant about people's spiritual base, where they're coming from, you know.
Yeah.
So I see this as part of that change. After World War II, after the Nazis, there was this move to, you know, let's just keep religion out of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's been, no, we really need to educate everyone about religion, so it can't be misused as, oh, those monsters over there we don't know anything about. Anyway, let's move into this second hat that you wear at the Tony Blair Faith Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also responsible for managing the foundation's relationship between Yale University and their project, the foundation's project called Faith and Globalizations Initiative. What's that one about?
Right. That one is about a couple of different things. We have a network of universities that are involved in the Faith and Globalization Initiative, and it has really a couple of different parts to it. One part is also religious literacy, like what we've been talking about in the schools program. It really revolves around courses at the university level that are taught around the topic of faith and globalization. And, of course, these courses are more independently structured across the LEED University network so that each of the universities is teaching a quote-unquote faith and globalization course, but they may be structured somewhat differently, but they generally cover the same basic ground, which is really to lay a foundation for understanding how, or beginning to understand at least, how religion and globalization are forces that work together in a variety of different and very complex ways, and to tease that out. And the motivation for this...
They also work in opposition. I mean,
yes,
sometimes it's religion that's protecting people from the forces of economic globalization.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. So it's that complex kind of relationship between the forces that we are interested in having people in higher education start to think about and start to teach the leaders of tomorrow about, so that as they go off into their various and very diverse professions in the future, they'll have some sense of the role that religion plays. Because as you just were talking about the textbooks, it's the same in higher education, if not even more divided, you know, in terms of religion content. You know, religion usually is over there in that divinity school, and we don't know what they're doing over there exactly.
Right.
And so this is, again, another level of trying to integrate content about it for people who are going to go into business or people who are going to go into politics or policy development. So in addition to the teaching piece, then we're also at the university level working to encourage research into the intersection between religion and globalization, so that we're developing the resources that policymakers need to make better decisions in the future about how to mobilize religion as a force for good. So from Tony Blair's perspective, this is one thing that he wishes he had had when he was in office.
Huh.
Was some really significant, substantial, well-grounded research on that would have helped him make better decisions about how to address these issues. So that's sort of what we're doing at the university level.
Well, yeah, it sounds good to, you know, be talking to young people, college-age people, about these policy issues and everything you just said. I noticed on the website for the Tony Blair Faith Foundation, there was a question on this project, and it said, is the assumption that globalization is a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
And they must have gotten some pushback early on. And they say the answer is, oh, yes, we realize that there are pressures on various local communities because of the forces of globalization, but we feel that overall it's going to lead to positive things. So I have to say, as a person who's been situated in the critique of economic globalization movement for more than 20 years, I kind of wondered why he chose that word. And you could say, you know, it's an initiative about religion in the modern world, because as I say, there are a lot of times where religious groups really join with people trying to protect themselves from getting completely disempowered and paved over by transnational corporations and economic globalization. And I think, you know, Tony Blair is a leader of one of the main industrial players. There was always an assumption for a long time that a certain model of development was the good model, which wasn't building up the local economy. So I don't doubt that he's shifted now. It just seems curious to me to use that word as an umbrella term for everything that religion and modernity, people in this modern situation, religion in the 21st century would be doing. It seems like it skews it a little bit, but is that how it plays out, or how do you see that?
Well, that's a really interesting observation, and I think that the way it plays out is that it actually does raise that question. As you saw, there's the question there on the website, is this a good thing? And that's exactly what happens, is that as people start to look at globalization as a factor, as a force, as an actual force that is happening, no matter how much we might not want it to be that way in certain cases, it is happening, and it does force people to ask a lot of questions about what it's doing and whether we want to go there. And I think I've seen several different instances in which, for example, when the topic is around issues of fair trade and things like mm-hmm. human trafficking, you know, that's where you see that religious dimension of it raising a hand and saying, you know, we need to really think seriously about this and how we can counteract some of this.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think it does actually provide, it provides a healthy and dynamic space for people who want to question globalization as a runaway force, right?
Right.
So I think that's really what it's doing, and that's the positive side of it.
Well, we should say, too, that there's the concept, as Richard Falk labeled it, globalization from the ground up. So
yeah.
At the grassroots level, of course, through the Internet connections, a lot of groups are having horizontal communication, and you really facilitate this horizontal communication because, you know, when you say, well, economic globalization is happening, well, it's happening because some people got a hold of the laws and rewrote the laws to
right.
favor transnational corporations, and there are a lot of people now who, you know, want to revisit that and change the whole aid package into building up community-based economics instead of just trying to bring the big transnational corporate factory in and to save the day, and then it'll pull out in 5 years when it finds somewhere cheaper to exploit. So,
mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I see this. I mean, to bring people together talking about this can only be a good thing. And as long as it did seem to me on the website that they were open to the critique being part of the conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the strength of all of these programs. We are not afraid of difference and disagreement. And in fact, I would say one of the real underlying motivations and also guiding principles for all of these programs is that we have to learn as a race of people, you know, human beings have to learn how to disagree in a way that can become productive, that doesn't always have to lead to division and violence,
mm-hmm.
that there's a way for us to have robust and productive disagreements, and we are trying to make spaces for that and trying to tease out the ways that the skills that are required and also, you know, provide the broad framework, you know, in terms of knowledge to be able to have those conversations when you get to more advanced levels.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that humans really require training in devaluing diversity, because I think we're naturally pretty solipsistic and self-absorbed as a species, and we tend to think that everybody thinks the way we do, and then we run into these disagreements where people don't at all think the way we do, even between males and females. Each sex assumes the other one thinks the way they do, and of course, as soon as they get into a relationship, they find out, oh my gosh, we're coming from entirely different emotional universes. But certainly with other people, you know, when you run into difference, it's not the automatic thing to say, oh, good, another perspective. Now we'll have a bigger view of the picture. You know, if we have 10 perspectives on this instead of 2, so much the better. I think in diversity of all kinds, people still don't even get why it's better to have diverse views around a table if you're trying to figure out something, you know, whether it's a community organization or the Security Council at the United Nations. I mean, you want the different perspectives so you can build as comprehensive a sense of the issue as possible. So I see this as another positive thing that's probably going into that formation of the young people.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, and to add to all of that, what you just said is that our tendency is to not seek out the difference in the first place either.
Right.
And to self-segregate anyway, you know, among other people that we feel are like us.
That's right.
And similar to us. So I agree. I think that's one of the real strengths of both of the programs is, and all three actually, is to provide these spaces that are somewhat safe and somewhat facilitated for people to just even start experimenting with being with, speaking with, and sharing with people who are really different from themselves.
Yeah. Well, with your background, what have you learned going into this work? It's at a planetary level. I know you were working inside the United States before, which was a big enough pool. But what have you learned since going into this global level Tony Blair Faith Foundation?
Well, it's interesting. I'm definitely I've learned a lot, and I feel like I'm in a major learning curve still, continuing a major learning curve because. You're right, you know, dealing with this arena in the United States was dynamic and challenging enough on its own, but it's a culture that I knew and felt really familiar with. So for me, the interaction with different cultures has been probably, and I'm fairly familiar with religious differences too, having studied religion, but the cultural differences have been really fascinating to me, and I've learned a lot. And I think one of the major things that it's raised for me is the willingness, especially coming from a background in the First Amendment, the religious liberty clauses, making that clear to educators in such a way that it made space for both religious people and non-religious people to be treated fairly and respectfully, to then go out into an arena where by no means is that accepted as the right way to address religious or worldview diversity in a culture. There are lots of different ways to do it. And so I find myself now really weighing all of those and being fascinated with the different ways that people do it and being challenged in myself not to carry with me, you know, that American Western notion that we've got that whole religious diversity thing figured out, you know.
Right.
And so it's a, yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, we're getting to running out of time here.
Yeah.
But that was inspiring and something we should all keep in mind, you know, because we are raised in this culture that sort of implicitly teaches us that we have all the answers. So, yeah, thank you so much for being with us, Marcia Beauchamp.
You're welcome, Charlene. It was a pleasure.
Well, let's move on over to the Arts Corner and see what we have there today. Since we've been talking about religion, we're going to hear a poem about an energetic, very little girl running down the aisles of a cathedral. This poem is by Annie Finch. And by the way, just last week, her new collection of selected poems from the past 40 years was published. The title of that new book is Spells, as in Witching Woman. So the title is Spells. Be the first person on your block to own it. This poem is from her earlier collection entitled Eve, and the poem is Running in Church. Then you were a hot-thinking, thin-lidded tinderbox. Losing your balance meant nothing at all. You would pour through the aisles in the highest cathedrals, careening deftly as patriarchs brooded. You made the long corridors ring, tintinnabular echoes exploring the pounded cold floor, forcing the walls to the truth of your progress. There was a person in this church's core. Past thick stained glass colors wafted and swirling in pooled interludes that swung down from the rafters, cinnabar wounds through light on your face, where the pliant young bones were dissolving in laughter. Now, for our song today, well, I started this program 1 year ago tomorrow. And in the course of this first year, we've heard lots of different vocalists, different kinds of instrumental groups, from chamber, classical, Quebecois folk, just about everything. But what we haven't heard yet is the divine Shirelles, whom, by the way, I actually got to meet backstage one time when they came to my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, in 1965. Oh, yes. So here is one of the Shirelles' big hits, recorded in 1961, Tonight's the Night.
You said you're going to meet me.
Was the Shirelles with Tonight's the Night. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCame, will be here with her guest, Michael Schumann, author of The Small Mart Revolution and Local Dollars, Local Cents. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Rob Beat, co-author of Enough is Enough. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.